So this is Kate Magruder. It is August 27th, 2018. I'm recording an oral history for Promise of Paradise, Oral Histories of Back to the Land Movement in Mendocino County. Would you introduce yourself?
I am Mika Wawona, a longtime resident here since 1972, I'm thinking.
And where and when were you born?
I was born in Otten, Oklahoma, actually in Fort Sill, where Geronimo was imprisoned, 1953. And I traveled a lot, moved a lot, went to school in a lot of states because I was an Army brat is what they called me. My father was a public relations officer for the Army, and so we moved a lot.
When you were growing up, moving around as you did, what else was formative in your life? What do you think as a young person shaped you and your point of view?
Well, I spent a lot of time going out in the hinterlands. And when I was young, that many years ago, so I'm 64 or 5 right now, where backyards were like fields and caves and places to go hiking and look at nature. And I used to have play with, one of my things was to do anthills and bring rocks and stuff where they could put a little cave underneath it. And then they'd move under there. And then I'd put little breadcrumbs or something. And I'd go out in fields, and my sister and brother weren't interested at all, but I always had to be called in, you know. So that was wonderful, all the different environments that I was in over the years.
And what was the path that led you to Mendocino County? Tell me about why you came and when you came to, around the time you came to Navarro River and the encampment you found there.
I was at UC Santa Cruz, and I planned on doing studies in environmental fields, science and stuff, and thought maybe I'd be teaching that at some point. But the more I spent time outside on the land and going, you know, having lectures in the field or this or that, I thought, I want to live on the land. I want to live in where all these environments are meshing together and learning and watching the natural process of things. More interested in that than actually, you know, going to a movie. So why up there? Because we met some people who had come back from there where they had experienced that encampment on the Navarro River, where what happened was, is my understanding, was there was a whole lot of people in the Big Sur area doing an encampment. It was rugged, and I forget who got them to move out of there. Then they went up to San Francisco to Haight-Ashbury, and there was a big park there. Golden Gate Park, yes, right. And they got rolled out of there, and they went up in caravans of vehicles and paintings and all that stuff and did encampments there. And it was like... Oh, what's how a period of time where musicians would walk through the streets and the streets were full of little vendors and all of that. That's what it was like there. Women were suckling other people's babies so that then they could go do something. People were weaving. People were making food, chapatis or whatever, and selling that. And it was like a self-sustaining. Everything you needed was there. So you could stay there. You had to find your niche and what you could do.
When was that?
There on the Navarro, that would have been in 1972. It's possible went into 73. I think it was 72. And there wasn't trash left around. There wasn't people going out and squatting for going to the bathroom. Everything was really well done. And it was like, where did we learn this? Or how did they, you know, it was like Boy Scout, Girl Scout, you know. Then as the group kind of got to a point where we realized there was like enough, that the capacity had been reached, there was some looking at other places in the Navarro, and also people would, like I just said, doing town runs to Ukiah. I don't know why not Fort Bragg, but it was more of a hamlet back then, and get supplies and bring them back. And then people started going, oh, there's another whole place here, Ukiah Valley. And that's when my partner and I saw a notice on a bulletin board, and it was Buckles Corner Store. And, you know, as the back to the land people had come, a store grew up to feed, to have the food and all the goodies for that. And so there was a sign about McNabb Ranch and parcels being sold, sizes, blah, 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 who to contact. And we did do that. And we bought 10 acres. I used some of my scholarship money, and it was the best education I ever had. I used my scholarship money at UC Santa Cruz. I didn't go back for my second year, you know. Woo! Don't tell anybody I said that. But it was a great education. So let me tell you about the freeze. The freeze was so bad, deep, that the trees, the big giant oak trees throughout the watershed were blowing up. They were exploding because there was ice, that water inside the trees that just blew up, just expanded like ice does. So you could just hear it like shrapnel, I don't know what, all over in the valley. So it was like, oh my gosh. So just to, so I don't forget this aspect, was just a few years later, there were huge forest fires, or fires, let's say, woodland fires around the county, because where all those trees went down, once any fire got anywhere, there was so much fuel there. So there was big fires all the way really from the coast, the south coast, all the way inland to like the McNabb area and maybe Hopland.
Tell me about, I think it was maybe during that freeze, about the caravan of trucks you saw.
Yes. So I lived back in the very back of McNabb Ranch, and I could see down the valley through the flat valley to where the highway 101 was north-south right there. I could see this caravan. It just was like endless trucks and vehicles. I had no idea what that was about. Like, you know, was there some dangerous, was there an earthquake or whatever was making that happen? Al and Farida Krause lived in the old McNabb Ranch house. And so they were down in the valley, and I'd heard from them or talked with them. I'd go down them to use a phone because there wasn't a phone where I lived. And they told me what happened. And from my spot up on the hill, you know, before I talked with them, I saw all those trucks going down there to get, you know, restock Ukiah Valley's plumbing supplies. Amazing.
So when you bought your land, then what did you live in?
When I first was able to get onto the land, I was living in a camper on the back of my pickup truck. And I had my little baby who was born in, well, at Stanford, but we had to go there from Santa Cruz Mountains. And my partner had been picked up for being AWOL. He had come home from his first tour of duty for a leave of absence, and then he was going to be going back. And there was no way he could go back. So he went AWOL, and that was very, very difficult. And he had to hide for quite a while. There was a number of people going AWOL, and the repercussions of that were great. So there I was with me and my little baby in the camper on the back of the pickup truck. And I had heard you could go to the Lake Mendocino, had some bathrooms with showers in them. And there I'd meet these like-minded people from different parts of inland Mendocino County. And I met a man who had a pickup truck. And I found out or asked, oh yeah, in Redwood Valley, the hamlet of Redwood Valley, there was a long shed or barn that was dilapidated, was falling apart. And I found out who the owner was by going to the corner, the store on the corner there of the intersection Redwood Valley, and they told me who did. So I contacted him and I said, I have a truck and a crew and we'll take this barn down for you if you want. And they said yes. Of course, back then you didn't worry about liability or any of that stuff. And so we did that. We took the person that I was doing it with was on Greenfield Ranch. So one of the truckloads would go to his place and the other truckload would go down to McNabb to my place. And it was wonderful wood. Old growth redwood, it was amazing, of all the 2x4s and then the shakes and shingles and the planks, and we were so fortunate. So built a cabin, and here's the other part of it. I didn't do it all by myself, that's for sure. Yes, so my partner was still back in Fort Ord doing time for being AWOL, going back down to that place at the camp at Lake Mendocino. There was a couple from the southeast. And I said, would you be into helping me build a cabin and you can stay there for at least the winter and spring and we can figure things out? And they said yes. And so they helped me do that. The guy knew what he was doing. We built one and a half sort of stories, you know, the second story was only half. And so I lived there by myself because my partner was still at Fort Ord. Yeah, I had my little baby, and that was pretty amazing. And I don't know if I should say who my little baby is now. She's the my daughter is the deputy auditor of Mendocino County. So wow, math was never my thing. So
describe to me how McNabb Ranch was organized at the time. Was there an agreement between people who lived on McNabb Ranch?
The problem was that there was no agreement or entity on McNabb Ranch that could adjudicate disagreements between neighbors, that could be responsible for the road system, have some kind of a central functioning like board of directors to deal with issues, nothing. And many of the subdivisions happened like that because Mendocino County illegally was not, probably didn't know what they were doing. They were approving these subdivisions without the Subdivision Act. The Subdivision Act said that you have to have a body, an entity that is responsible for what goes on that private land. And McNabb didn't, and many places didn't. So it meant that if you had a disagreement, you had to like argue it out and argue it out. And if you couldn't agree, thankfully I never heard of people taking it to blows, but then you'd have to go to court. And then that would start clogging up the courts. And it wasn't just McNabb Ranch. It was, you know, it was up and down. It was Humboldt County to the lesser degree. It was more the areas and Sonoma County where the old sheep ranches went down. And that was because mutton was coming, lamb was coming from off the coast of South America, coming up here cheaper than our ranchers could produce. So there wasn't any process. And so there was a lot of mistakes made, a lot of very bad road systems put in, lots of damage to the watershed, just horrific. So we had in the 1972, the freeze, 72, 73, this huge freeze. And then in mid 1970s, 74, 75 in there, after all those trees had fallen down, like there was all these fires and there was no entity to bring people together to fight them and deal with them, or even know who's up what road or not. So thank God there was a lawsuit against the county for not having this subdivision act, you know, not complying with it, and that made a big difference. And Greenfield actually had a governance. The common land with the ranch house and the facilities and barn and all this stuff, Tim Baker from Berkeley, who bought it and decided to subdivide it, he did the best job of anything that I was aware of, because he made sure that the common land didn't go to some rich person, but that was, if you bought in, you were in that association and you had rights to work with other people and use it to whatever the group was deciding. And it's really gone very well.
You not only had rights, but you also had, well, you had responsibilities to the, yes, or to the association.
Right. Yeah, at Greenfield, you had a responsibility to comply with the different articles and incorporations and the bylaws. And we had a manager and we had a board of directors, and people could come to the meetings on monthly meetings. And then there was the general corporate meetings once a year, where more serious things that got dickered over and decided during the course of the year then got put into action. In terms of like developing water or roads just couldn't be punched in willy-nilly. So you had to go to the board and the neighboring parcels. And this was, you know, all that stuff was very, very important, because I saw what happened on McNabb Ranch and some of the other ranches and was continuing to happen. There was no rules. So it was only after bad consequences occurred that you could get somebody to do something about it, or try to bring in water quality or whoever else that could maybe come in and help get this person to comply with what made sense or what was state law.
What did you do for money? How did you begin to find your way, find your footing?
My first job up here, I used to work at Macy's and Emporium back down in the Bay Area when I was in Palo Alto. And my first job was, I don't know how I got to this, I raised worms. I was into worms for humiculture, for what it did for your gardens. And amazing, you could grow so much in a small area with that, the richness. And then somebody said, well, you've got so many worms in here, you could sell them for bait. And there was a guy down in Redwood Valley, at the Redwood Valley store, that sold bait. So I sold bait. I sold worms, bait worms. It's pretty funny. And then, you know, Shamise, my daughter, could help me with that. She'd love to pick the worms out of the thing. I still have some of the bins, but, you know, that's not what I do for a living now. Oh, yeah. And then I started noticing that things needed to happen. There was damaged watersheds and by the bad roads put in. There was poor logging practices happened. All of that stuff. And I lived intimately with the consequences if things were not done well according to the laws of watershed function. And so, I mean, there was a long period of time where, you know, it was just one disaster after another, and the county had to even put bridges in because roads would go out because the county didn't have the staff or even the knowledge, really, to get ahead of these kinds of things. So the county had been behind and just struggling to catch up with the rate of people moving in and doing these things and catching up with what the regulations were and how to apply them. And stuff was going to court, and that was tying a bunch of stuff up. So
where did you go? Did you go to CEMER?
I realized a lot of things needed to happen, both in watershed restoration and in forest thinning management. What forestry was going on was just simply cherry picking. All it was not forestry. It was timber cutting. It was taking the best of the trees out of the stand and leaving everything else behind. And there was no rules about where you run your tractor up and down the hill to drag logs out. There was nothing. There was no Forest Practice Act. And so that was really turning a lot of us that were living out in the hills, it was really damaging. This filled the creeks, the fish were buried, the eggs were buried. The creeks and rivers would go out of their banks and wash things out, and even properties, you know, private properties. So then there was a movement from Mendocino and Humboldt County to go to Sacramento to the forestry board and say, we need these regulations because this is what's happening. These once large forest holdings by timber companies and by big, large sheep ranches is completely different now. It's willy-nilly, and this has got to be dealt with. Zeeberg and Nedgely, they were both the chairs of the Natural Resources Committees in the Senate and the Assembly in Sacramento. And a little later than this was a Redwood National Park up in Humboldt County. The giant, giant redwoods that, thank God, were, I think, under Roosevelt, preserved as this incredible thing, legacy for the future, the massive, massive groves. But they were being, Louisiana Pacific and Georgia Pacific were being able to log around the boundaries and uphill of the park, and it caused damage into the park. So then that act was formed, and then the rules were there, and things went to court, and finally things were starting to turn around. But it was myself and some others were realizing the damage has been done. We have to do something because these things may have happened 5 or 10 years ago. They're still unraveling. They're still pouring into these both stem and steelhead streams, but also into these estuaries where the fish need to come in to raise their young. I went with some other folks to Washington, D.C. Becking, Rudy Becking, professor at UC Humboldt, and John Amadeo and different people from the North Coast Environmental Center. We went to Washington, D.C. and had showed these big pictures of the damage, and satellite photographs showed the damage, the extent of the damage. It was like, oh, you can't argue with that. And so I remember talking with Senator Aberesk, who was, I think, the only Native American in the Senate. And I had a slideshow presentation, and it was quiet in the room. A lot of people go there for about this or that, but when you got footage and you got satellite photos and you go, yeah, this is a problem. Can you see that? He said to his staff that was sitting there in the hearing, he said, give this, work with this woman, give her what she wants. And they did. So, which was to develop a watershed restoration program for Redwood National Park and to make it be a template for what needed to happen. And I didn't pursue on the federal level what the regulation should be to prevent it from happening. I couldn't bite off more than that. I had a little daughter in tow. And so that went to like the Humboldt County in NEC, North Coast Environmental Center, they worked on that, getting rules changed. So then I went to Sacramento because we needed, it wasn't just a federal, that was federal with Redwood National Park and the damage there, but we needed a state regulations because it was picking up and going faster by the corporations. And so a group of us, including some of the people I just mentioned, Rudy Becking and John Amadio and different people from Humboldt County, but also activists from Mendocino County, we went to Sacramento to Jerry Brown's office. That was his first term. And we did a sit-in in his office because actually it was my idea. I heard that because I was talking to one of the staff people there in one of the Senate committees, and he said that Walter Mondale was going to be coming. The candidates for president were coming into the Capitol, California Capitol, to do the glad handing and meet with people to support them and fall in line with them in their campaigns. So we knew that was the time to do it because the TV crews were going to be there. So we had these massive aerial photographs, big wall size, and pictures of old growth trees and the forest itself. So the place was mobbed with the media. Jerry Brown had one of his staff people come and talk to me and another man and say, I'd like to go to dinner. Let's go to dinner and let's talk about this. So yay, that was great. Because, you know, he had seen the stuff himself and he saw how it caught people's eyes. And
so tell me about what you were wearing when you flew to Washington, D.C., must have been in the mid-70s, to make a case.
Well, it's funny. I didn't have anything I thought I could wear. So I went to my mom's and looked through her closet, and I pulled out a lovely polyester dress with a plastic belt, and I hadn't worn stockings since I was in high school, and pumps. And put my hair in a French roll and with pins in it. And I had little reading glasses. I did, you know, I was pretty darn young. Did I say how old I was? It was like, you know, early 70s. And how old would I have been? I was born in 53. Yeah, early 20s. Who's going to listen to somebody, a bopper like that? So anyway, and it all pulled off there. I managed to walk around in those high heels. And
what would you normally be wearing at home on McNabb or wherever you are?
I would normally just pull on a pair of pants with a lot of pockets. You need those pockets, and a vest with pockets, and have some layers on top so that when you got too hot, when you're working, you could, you know, layer it down and even tuck some of that maybe in put on later as the evening started coming on. So quite different. And I didn't have anything to wear, so I had to go to my mother's and go through her closet.
And then tell me, when you were in Sacramento lobbying Jerry Brown, tell me about that meeting where you were all sitting around a big table. That's when he was sitting next to you.
Yeah.
And he put his hand on your hand.
Uh-huh. Well, I think when we were talking with Jerry Brown and trying to describe to him what was going on, what the problem was how much it impacted so many different resources. It wasn't just forestry. It had to be a broader view because it was causing erosion. It was causing water quality problems. It was killing fish and smothering fish eggs and spawning, and had all these ramifications, and also was being cut in such a way, high grading the very best trees always, was leaving a forest stand with not good structure, not good wood for the next harvest around or the next generation. So there were so many aspects. We needed a Forest Practice Act, and that legislation came up during Jerry Brown's term, and you know, there was a big battle, and those two senator and assemblyman stood up and fought all the fray. And it happened. So there was enough hue and cry, thank goodness, that it happened at least then. It was too bad so much was lost prior to that. But I think also people started realizing you could actually go to the Capitol and get through to somebody. especially if you did it with others, you had different people in your community that represented different interests but could see all sort of come together around central issues that affected the different parts of the community. Wasn't good for loggers either. If you tear up the forest, there's not going to be a good stand next time around. Or loggers liked fishing, you know, a lot of them lived, you know, that was their lifestyle. So they were having a big lesson in seeing how this was causing such damage to spawning grounds, etc. So it started bringing different facets of the community together. And there was a lot more meetings. Sometimes they were some yelling back and forth, but some good facilitators would keep you on track and there would be movement and some things were changed and you got more agreement and you just had to do it because we were sort of at the beginning of this unraveling or forming some new kind of cohesion in community before state and federal laws could figure out what needed to be done. Local people were seeing the consequences and coming together and putting time and energy in, and some would yell at each other, others would sit down and go, let's have a committee and let's get into this. And so change happened and people really dug in.
How did you connect with Tom Umpere and Seymour, and what did you propose to him?
A state program came into effect, Comprehensive Employment Act, CETA. Training Act, Comprehensive Employment Training Act. And under that, some different entities throughout the state formed to receive funds to do training in the community on various parts of the economy and needs for the community. And up in our area, it was things that were happening in terms of the decimation of our fisheries and the high grading and reducing the value in of the forests. And so some of us came together and went to CEMER, Center for Education Manpower Resources, thinking, gosh, we should be developing these training programs in these fields that need this work. We needed to do legislation to stop this stuff from happening, but we needed new careers. And Tom Umpere was involved in Wayne Honeycutt at the Center for Education Manpower Resources. And we went to them and sat down and talked and said, we need to do some training in these fields because there's going to be more and more of these problems until things can be turned around to stop creating all these problems. Then it sort of morphed into other things. In the timber industry, a lot of wood went to waste. They would saw these wonderful planks out of the central part of the tree logs, and then the rest was just scrap. They thought, oh, well, we'll just shred it, or it was just left around some of the smaller mills. They didn't know what to do with it. So some of us thought, well, some of this wood is actually usable for small products, for different types of things. I mean, everything from toys to bookcases to doors. And so we got some CETA grants along those lines, and people trained in that. At the beginning, it was all men, but then later some women got into it too and ended up creating their own businesses, creating different products out of that post-milling phase.
How did you start New Growth Forest Service? Tell me about that.
When we first started New Growth Forestry, we went under partnership rules. It was much easier to do. And it was made up of a group of people from mostly Greenfield Ranch who had been working together in the esprit de corps, the people trying to figure out how to do things right and better. So we thought, well, we should form our own group doing this. We were training people to do this. Why don't we form a business to do this? So we figured out how to do a partnership. And most of the people from Greenfield Ranch, they had had experience working together on road systems and firewood cutting and house building, you know, where you learn to work with a crew of people and you don't always get your way, but you got, you know, you mesh all these good ideas together and things come out wonderful. So it's encouraging. And so we did that. Our first jobs were thinning jobs. We did some on the coast, on Point Arena. And It was very successful. Homeowners just couldn't deal with the fire hazard around them, and it was starting to become clear and clearer that that was a problem. The Back to the Landers moved into the forests and the wildlands.
Tell me about the Ventana. What was wonderful about doing that work with that group of people in a place called the Ventana Wilderness?
And the next job we did was a trail job. It was a rebuilding job of during the CCC, a lot of trails were put in throughout the state and country, but there was no maintenance of them, really. So at CEMER, we had all these contracts were coming out, going to these different entities where the state or the feds were needing to have work done. They weren't going to put federal crews out or state crews out, but they were going to have private companies, contractors bid on it. So we formed a partnership, and that was our first job. It was just behind Big Sur. So it was the backside of Big Sur, way out in Arroyo Seco, way out in it was a wilderness area. It was so exciting. All of us loved spending time outside, campfire, children, in tow, and just beautiful surroundings. And we were young, we could do it. Probably 10 or 20 years later, we might not want to, but it was just fabulous. And that was the time, too, that we started having sweat lodges. Not exactly like the real thing, Native American sweat lodges, but we improvised, and that's how we got clean. So we'd get in there and sweat and sing songs and prayers and praise each other or say, we need to talk about some stuff tonight or tomorrow morning, or whatever. It was so wonderful to be with family and friends and community, and that was doing our livelihoods and learning from each other. How to use tools, how to cook, how to use a chainsaw, whatever.
How were you moving through the Ventana Wilderness? What was your mode of transportation?
When we did our work there, getting our tools in, our camp supplies, food, runs, all of that, it was mostly packed in, but we had horses and a donkey. The donkey kept the horse string more mellow and assured, and so we pack up, and we had our packer crew, who the mostly guys, and Sarah McCarter, yes. So she was really the only woman that was hardcore into it. I mean, I was with horses, doing stuff with horses too, but not like her. She was an amazing woman. So it was just delightful. And then as time went on, we got more contracts, and then we decided, we better form a corporation that has more cover the butt type of stuff. So we got a contract for the Sierra Pack Trail, but that wasn't the exact name of it. And so we were up there for two different summers, the entire summers, with our whole families, all the kids in tow. Kids had chores and jobs, tending the animals, picking their feet, feeding them, and babies were there. And it was, it was amazing. We loved it. And we had enough skills of cooperation from our first jobs and from living in community at Greenfield Ranch in these communes. So it was perfect. We were young, and our kids got so much invigorated and had to have a job to do and to see the change of before and after, that you could make changes and make things better. Because different areas of that Pacific Crest Trail, that was what it was called, Pacific Crest Trail, were eroded out terribly. And that's one of the reasons the contracts went out, or that's the reason, was the packers and the tourists walking the trails. But not all of them are packers. They would bring people out because most people weren't into doing that hard thing of getting their stuff in there. But they were, their horses were breaking legs. It was just bad. So we spent two different summers doing that, and it was just the time of our lives. We loved that so much. We were the right age and a good group working together.
Can you remember a song that you especially like to sing in a sweat?
Oh, it occurs to me to sing one of the songs that we would sing in the sweat lodge. I'm not sure what its origin is. Spreading our long winged feathers as we fly, spreading our long winged feathers as we fly, we circle around we circle around the boundaries of the earth. You sing me and I sing you, we'll sing each other a song. You sing me, I sing you, we'll bring each other along. Ho! Is that it?
So tell me about the state, the California CCC.
On another occasion, some of us had talked about the need for a California Conservation Corps because there was so much damage being done to our forests and our waterways. And there was a federal CCC, but we figured out that we shouldn't pattern it exactly the same way. So we had to do a lot of just research about how to make something like this happen. And I had heard when I was at UC Santa Cruz, and Paige Smith and Paul Lee were professors there, and they were involved in the original CCC during the Depression, and the initiation of it, or how it was at first, they were very discouraged because it was like man against nature and like doing almost like development work or something. And they didn't like that. They didn't want that. And they formed a esprit de corps, of which Paige Smith and Paul Lee were very involved. And they said, we need to do away with man against nature. We need to work with nature and learn from nature, and then that can change as we go forward how we live in nature, or, you know, with our resources. They were just marvelous and so well thought of and loved in the community. And we asked them if they would help us start up a new California Conservation Corps. So they were so gracious to talk with us, and we said, we have a lot of energy. We want to make something like this happen in our generation. It's so needed even more than before. And could you help us with knowing how best to put that together? And so then we had a conference. We figured out that the Mendocino Woodlands, just outside of town of Mendocino and on the Big River, there was an old encampment there that was built, beautiful lodges and cabins, and it was built decades and decades before when a Finnish ship went ashore off of the town of Mendocino, the hamlet of Mendocino, and these Finnish sailors came ashore and they needed housing because this was pre, you know, there was just a little hamlet at Mendocino and they were couldn't be overwhelmed with this huge, I forget how many crew on there. And so they went to work on Big River, the banks of Big River, and cut down trees and built just stunning cabins and lodges because it was a huge, apparently huge ship, a lot of sailors and crew, just beautiful work. So when we were starting the CCC, we thought, gee, we should do it there, the Mendocino Woodlands. So when we were down in Santa Cruz talking about, let's have this encampment and talk about this and how it needs to evolve or be developed so we don't make mistakes and we're not wasting time doing it right or in the best form. So there was all kinds of people from the state of California. Jerry Brown was like, get over there and get on this. And he had Sim Vandren, who was actually the head of alternative technology. So he was into the solar systems and all of that kind of stuff. That was what he had been responsible for. But he was sort of waylaid and said, okay, put that aside for right now and let's make this thing happen. So we had this big conference there, and besides Paige Sis and Paul Lee, there was a couple other guys who were still alive from the CCC. So it was so sweet. And there were people from different departments and agencies to how do we need this? If we do, what agencies could use this help? This isn't a private undertaking. This is for the state. And there's a lot of things that the state has to deal with, whether it's around riverbanks or developments happen around state land. So let's train people, let's do this, and have a corps ourselves, a conservation corps ourselves. And so it was so invigorating that the people that came from the different counties and were so excited about it because they saw the need for it. So it was wonderful to work with groups of people, break down into committees, and come up with, here's how we think we can deal with this problem or this or that. And that the CCC is still happening today. And it helps young people realize there's something else there than simply desk jobs or going into a corporation or whatever. We need to take care of our wetlands and our rivers and our mountains and hills and all that stuff. And they weren't teaching it in school. So a lot of people, they were interested in those kinds of careers and bringing them back to their community, what they learned, and started new things in other ways, like new growth forestry.
So let's cut to you moving to Greenfield Ranch.
In the later 70s, I decided to move to Greenfield Ranch because it had a unifying structure. It had a board of directors, a common land where community meetings and gatherings would happen. And McNabb Ranch didn't have that. Very few, if any, had that at that time because there was no Subdivision Act. But the developer was wise enough to do that. So there was a whole structure, corporate structure, and it was great. So I decided to move with my new partner to Greenfield Ranch, to a property that had, it was just all kinds of resources. It was wonderful, a nice cabin. And I had really wanted to live in a group of people, not just in a two people, in a couple, because I could see the need for living on the land. There's so much to do if you're going to be there responsibly and provide for yourselves. So we did have a commune there, and my partner, when we didn't have a place to live or move into, there was a giant, giant redwood tree that the fire had burned the inside out. You'll find these throughout the redwood forests. And he turned that into a wonderful bedroom with a little propane stovetop thing, and I could make breakfast for my daughter, and she could walk down the little road and path to the Greenfield Ranch House to school, because there was teachers, retired or migrated teachers from the Berkeley area that came, and here we had a Greenfield school, and there was quite a couple of age groups of grades there. So it was really very wonderful and rustic, and we learned so many skills, and it was so empowering. You know, and we'd go tear down a building and bring the materials back and work together and learn how to saw, hammer, use chainsaws and power tools. And we shared pickup trucks, and we did a lot of work parties together and learned how to work together. And I think we found that if you contribute in a community, it's just so uplifting. It makes you feel secure, makes you feel like you have a place, you can contribute something, and you're learning constantly instead of doing it the same old, same old, same old if that one's not really working for you. You know, something that really just sort of came up for me as a realization that people care deeply for one another, that the community around them, around us, is more hopeful. You feel like you can do, we can do, and we feel more secure. It's sustainable. We can live right by what we believed instead of feeling, oh gosh, I know this isn't the best way, but it's the quickest, or the weather's coming in, so I've just got to do it this way or that way. But living in a small community, I'm not saying you could do this in a larger, I can't imagine it myself in a giant commune, but small little neighborhood or couple neighbors, families, it was just amazing. And then we went around from place to place when a house building raising was happening, or barn raising, or putting up fencing, or making a better road and things like that, helping develop water. And oh, we got to figure it out. I don't want to take your water from you, so let's figure out the right way so we're managing this properly, rather than each man and woman for themselves. So it was really invigorating and exciting to see that we could live a different way. And instead of like necessarily in a subdivision or a he comes first, whoever gets first gets this boil, you know. And the ranch is still working that way. It still has a great governing body, and the lands are better than they were. We've improved, and it's wonderful.
Who in the town of Ukiah or in the county, who has been, as you found your footing in Ukiah, who reached out to you? Who helped you? Who recognized you back then, early on, when there were the counterculture in the hills and then the established community? Tell me about Webb Brown and Dwayne Wells and Marge Boynton. Just what you can remember about how they might have interacted with you, received you.
Mm-hmm. I realized that in addition to the ramifications of the clear cutting that was going on in the forests, in addition to the damage to the resources, the river, the fish, that was also taking a toll on the county's viability in terms of natural wealth that the county would benefit from. So if you take forests that are large, and I'm not talking about old growth, there's only one time that there's old growth, but if you grow your trees to the size where you can make timber, lumber out of them, it's more useful to the community and it has a higher tax value, revenue for both those things. Whatever gets produced, made out of those logs is going to have more benefit to the county and will last much longer and benefit the community. And the timber tax on it will. And that should be that way because there is damage to put in the logging roads, and there's no way around it. So it needs to be, the timber needs to be of value enough to then be able to restore and do things in the best way, even if it's more expensive. And during that time, I met people from, let's say, the old guard. I mean, the people that were here long before we showed up. And one of them was Webb Brown. He was the county assessor. And I talked with him about what's going on out there. And his field people will go out in the field, but he didn't. He was the head of it. And so, but he surely knew. I'm not saying he didn't know, but I was pointing out to him that this so-called second growth was because the canopy was so open by clear cutting that the trees grew too fast. And so there was a wide growth rings. So wide growth rings, you can make fence pickets or planks out of. You can make some things with them, but you can't build 2x4s for studs and foundations and for framing and all that kind of stuff and rafters. So that was a loss, and it was a loss to the tax base to have apartment buildings and homes made out of real wood that would last for generations instead of particle board, plywood, blah, blah, blah. And he got it. And he came out and spoke about the forest practice regulations. Marge Boynton was on a wonderful, smart, savvy, funny gal. She was very, very good at getting, you know, things done. She was the head of the Planning Commission for a very long time and just very adept at it. And we would go for walks and talk. And there were some things we didn't agree about, and other things we did, and we really enjoyed each other's company, so we went for lots of walks. So she helped me, like, in terms of the subdivision. We needed to get ahead, not just Mendocino County drag its feet and let all this damage and wasted opportunity happen. You can't, like, redo road systems and rework all this stuff. So she was very open-minded and very savvy and very good at going to different people and kind of helping turn some heads around in terms of, we need some more rules and regulations. So those are some of the people, and there's a lot of others. So I'm just so grateful to have landed in Mendocino County, hallelujah, and have the good fortitude to be able to live here in such, you know, and it's wonderful, continues to be a wonderful county, and things are dealt with timely. You know, we don't have a lot of major problems.
Much of what you've said has spoken to how this experience has shaped you. But if you were going to add anything to that, the fact that you were compelled, you were drawn here.
I believe that people came here to Mendocino County from all these other places and walks of life because they were ready for change. They wanted to live in community, not just in a subdivision and you see somebody at the grocery store or you wave from your car when you're going into your house. It was like to be more than just neighbors, but let's work together so that this place can be right for the future, be something sustainable, something where I want to grow old in and my children to live in and grandchildren. And people were willing to dig in. They saw the hope, the prospect for doing that together. And so many, you know, diverse people, really, I think was just a big part of it as well. And people's willingness to try something new and struggle for it if necessary. So I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful. And everybody I know is going, I wish I could move out of here. Everybody's really, it seems like as we get older, people go, oh, hallelujah, we came here. So bless us all. We are so fortunate in this time in our lives to be together and work together and play together. And we'll just continue doing more and more. And I hope our children will stay here. Well, so many of them are. I mean, we're old enough that our children are here. And we're hoping that their children will. Bless our hearts.
We've been listening to a lightly edited interview with Mika Wawona as part of Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. This program airs on KZYX at 3:30 on Thursday afternoons. You can also catch shorter excerpts during the news hour on Thursday mornings at 7:45, 8:45, and 6 p.m. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.